emergencies. The revolutionary Berkey Light removes pathogenic bacteria, cysts, parasites, and harmful or unwanted chemicals to below detectable levels. It also removes foul tastes and odors like that rotten egg smell of sulfide, and it reduces nitrates and unhealthy minerals like lead and mercury while leaving in the healthful and nutritional minerals your body needs. The Berkey Light is so powerful it can purify raw, untreated water from remote lakes, streams, and stagnant ponds. The Berkey Light is transparent and glows in the dark with its rechargeable LED lighting system, so it can be used as a night light or camp light.
Get the Berkey Light Purifier for only $279. Call New Millennium, 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438, or order on the web at berkeywater.com.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of John Quirk. And John spent many years with our intelligence agencies. More recently, he is retired. He has an organization which goes around the world collecting money from banks that don't want to pay out for, or money that's being concealed here, there, elsewhere. He also teaches at the University over in Paris and has other connections in Europe. Fascinating individual. He's just back from the Middle East, so we want to get his ideas on what's going on with Iran, because we hear a lot of talks about the possibility of war with Iran, but is this all simply to get us scared and worked up and divert us from other important issues? And then what about Venezuela, which is just, you know, not too far away from us in South America there? What about the possibility that Chavez, could wreak some havoc with America? So with that as a background, John, I'm going to let you pick up the story. Go ahead.
Good evening. It's nice to be with you, Stan. Well, I would say our current information and policy on Iran is very confusing. It's confusing coming out of the Bush administration. There's a great difference of opinion between the Bush policymakers on what to do. Some of them, on one hand, want to attack Iran, Cheney, Bush. On the other hand, there are people advising for different reasons to let diplomacy try, let negotiations try, possibly that the Iranian government will be overthrown. Secretary of Defense Gates is advising against war. And, of course, we all know that the CIA last December rather sandbagged President Bush's plans on going to war with Iran with a report that the National Intelligence estimate that the Iranians have given up all their efforts on developing nuclear weapons. And now Europe today and the IAEA say that's not true. They say the Iranians, and so do the Israelis, are saying that, the Israelis and the Europeans and the IAEA are saying that the Iranians are actually accelerating their weapons-grade uranium program. So there's a lot of confusion. And just to highlight some of these things, that there are, you know, some diplomatic efforts going forward. Bush, as you all know, just visited Israel and assured them that the United States will support Israel in any way. So is McCain. We still have bad intelligence on exactly what the Iranians are doing. From our own intelligence community, that whole issue involves the number of centrifuges. David Albright, a former weapons inspector, said that now they are running at 50%, and I trust his intelligence more than some other aspects of the intelligence community. The Israelis have gone on major maneuvers to do dry runs in a possible attack against Iran. Just about a week ago, they carried out about 100 Israeli F-16 and F-15 fighters, went into maneuvers practicing attacks on Iran. So what I'd say today, things are very confusing, but what is happening, politics are taking over. And that politics involves Mr. McCain, who is running for president, and agreements with Israel and President Bush, versus Mr. Obama, who is talking about actually negotiating and dealing with the Iranians. And, of course, we've got the whole presidential election and these issues going back and forth.
Oh, that's how we'll be back in just a moment. Our guest, Mr. John Quirk, who spent a lifetime in intelligence. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is John Quirk, who's spent a lifetime in intelligence. He's now retired, has his own company where he travels the world, but he still has a lot of fascinating contacts. He's just back recently from the Middle East and the Near East, and of course he's well aware of what's going on in with Venezuela, and of course Chavez's efforts to embarrass the United States. And Chavez, apparently, who is the ruler, the president of Venezuela, seems to be more intent upon injuring the United States than he is really of even his own safety or staying in power. So you have to question what sort of mentality we're dealing with. But John was simply saying that the issue as far as an attack on Iran is, well, it's very confusing. There are a lot of things on one hand that would suggest there's going to be an attack on Iran. Things on the other say there's not. Or just last week we've heard about Israel using 100 of their fighter planes on a 1,500-mile sortie out of the Mediterranean. Very, very similar to what would happen if they were to attack Iran. But then on the other hand, if they were to attack Iran and they didn't wipe out all of their missile capacity, you could be sure that Iran would rain a whole, of really hundreds of rockets and missiles down on Israel and destroy the nation. So it really seems to be almost a standoff there, doesn't it?
It seems like there is. You know, getting back to the politics, when you first look at it, a military attack against Iran would seem to favor McCain in the presidential election. American voters might back the war effort and vote for McCain. On the other hand, an airstrike on Iran by the United States could heighten more animosity towards the Bush administration, and they link McCain to it. Israel is really the linchpin here, because Israel has, I think, better intelligence than we do. I think that they have now upgraded all of their attack capabilities, which they didn't even have a year ago. I think that they know they're going to get support from President Bush. He just came back. And Mr. McCain made a pledge to American Jews about 6 months ago that he would do something about Iran. He would not let them develop nuclear weapons. The other thing is, I don't think the Israelis believe in any kind of dialogue that Mr. Obama would do. The Israelis are somewhat terrified of Mr. Obama. And I get this from Israeli intelligence, diplomats in Israel. They can't get too involved in the American presidential campaign, but they are very worried. And where it all boils down to it, there are rumors that say if Obama is elected, if he's elected in November, Mr. Bush, before he leaves office, will attack Iran.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and John is simply quoting rumors that are coming out in Washington, D.C., and there's other contacts. And the first one was that if Barack Obama is elected by the American people as president in November, why in the period between the elections and of course, the turning over the country to Obama, why, of course, the United States would attack Iran? In other words, they want an attack, and they'd leave it for Obama. On the other hand, what would happen if John McCain were elected in November? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I think Bush would pass the mantle to him, and he would eventually give diplomacy maybe 6 months. And when I say diplomacy, there's a whole series of things on the table with Iran. The United States is talking about setting up a small office in Iran. Sarkozy in France has been very adamant against Iran. They're our ally. The European unions have gone ahead and frozen tremendous amounts of money in Iran's bank, Bank Melli. There are more sanctions. There were 3 to 5 different sets of sanctions put in place in the last couple months. And as I said, Mr. Gates in the Defense Department and other people think if we keep putting pressure on Iran, they will fold, the government will fold. I don't see that. I see that the Iranians are going to accelerate their weapons-grade program, and they may back off a little bit, but they'll have it in position that if they have to go ahead, they can develop a bomb pretty quickly. And there's all kinds of scattered intelligence, whether how much do they have, 160 kilograms of weapons grade, do they need 600? But I don't think the Israelis care about that anymore. I think the Israelis are taking Iran for its word that Iran, if they have a nuclear weapon, they would attack Israel. So one way or another, whether I think here's a couple scenarios. Either President Bush is going to do it if Obama is elected. If McCain is elected, McCain will do it within 6 months, attack Iran. And if not, the Israelis will monitor very, very closely what's happening in Iran and take action on their own. And you know, the Israelis have already done it twice. They attacked the Iraqi facilities in 1981, and they attacked, they bombed a structure in Syria that housed a nuclear reactor built with the aid of North Korea. That's just a couple months ago. So the Israelis have done it twice, two unilateral attacks against suspected nuclear sites. Now, there is a fourth scenario which is being floated, and that's seems to be the recent plan of President Bush, and he's kind of leaked it. And that is the fact that the United States could actually start hitting targets of the Revolutionary Guards in southern and southwestern Iran. That's right on the border with Iraq. And there's been more and more talk about Iranian complicity in attacks on Iraq. We just lost 4 Americans, I think, yesterday or today, and there's Iranian footprints. U.S. State Department officials and the military now have repeatedly claimed Iran is aiding Iraqi insurgents. So the United States has two precedents here. We did attack, we arrested 5 of their diplomats, so-called diplomats, last November. And then again, last September, Bush was able to get the Senate to vote 76-22, I think it was, to declare that the Revolutionary Guards were a terrorist organization. So it could start that way. It could start that way from the United States, attacking them to prevent more attacks against our soldiers and the Iraqi government. It's I would say, more than even a year ago, things are very, very confusing. You have the International Atomic Energy Commission now saying Iran is lying and not becoming forthcoming. A year ago, they were defending Iran almost. You've got the European Union, the new Europe, if you will, really supporting the United States. Sarkozy has really stuck his neck out with condemning Iran. You've got people in our government that want to do diplomacy where other people like Bush and Cheney want to take military action no matter what. And then you've got the mix here, the cauldron of the presidential election. And I think people in the Bush administration and Israel and Europe, for that matter, are very suspicious of Obama. They're mainly suspicious because he flip-flopped a couple times on Iran, where Mrs. Clinton has basically said that she would attack Iran to protect Israel. So the Democratic Party on this issue has not come out very strong in either favor or condemning Mr. Obama's plans with Iran. And I think that's going to play in the hands of the Republican Party.
But don't you think, of course, that the average American, I think the vast majority of Americans, are against the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and if the Republicans in over, we were to perceive that they were going to start a war with Iran, and when you start a war, you never know how it's going to end, wouldn't you think that it would even alienate more people from the Republican Party and the Republican candidate, John McCain?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and the point you bring up is also what's happening to our country now. Oil prices are skyrocketing. The economy is in a recession, no matter what anybody says. Mr. Greenspan came out basically and said, you know, we're headed to a very bad recession. It's going to take us a long time to get out. The Chinese are consuming all kinds of oil, and we are borrowing more and more billions of dollars from the Chinese. And the Iranians, I think, have in many ways outmaneuvered us because they formed an alliance with Chavez that basically says if we attack Iran, oil is going to be interrupted, and it could go, who knows, $10, $12 a barrel, okay? So the Iranians have a defensive strategy. I wrote about this about 2 years ago in Real Politics, and it's coming true. The Iranians have a strategy of oil, and that oil would affect our relations with China if we go to war, our relations with Europe if we go to war, and as you said, Stan, it could spread into a regional conflict. It could go over the border into Iraq. The Pentagon issued a report today that said the gains that we've made in Iraq could be reversible, and they're very fragile. One thing could take Iraq down the tubes again. So nobody wants that. So, but the whole issue is nobody talks about living with Iran. Everybody talks that we must do something quickly before they develop nuclear capacity and give it to Hezbollah. And so nobody really knows. I think that you're going to see more of a crisis develop in the next few months as the presidential election gets closer.
And, of course, one of the other things that really disturbs me is the American military. I mean, we have a great and very courageous military, but they've cut back on it so dramatically that we do not have any depth in the American military. This is why they have to extend the service time for these men, why some of them are serving their second or third tour of duty over there. And this destroys the morale of the troops. It destroys their families. And a lot of these are National Guardsmen who never joined up to actually go overseas to fight. They expected to be defending our nation. And if you read, I don't know if you've read General Sanchez's book on Sydney, what he learned when he was the commander over there, but he points out that we really do not have sufficient troops to fight that war, and then we expand the war over there, we would be leaving our troops open for terrible, terrible consequences.
Well, this is what the Iranians are hoping for, and of course Obama is talking about spending massive amounts of money, which we do need in this country. We have to rebuild our infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, our levees. We have to do something about fuel. You know, we have to develop alternate sources of fuel. We have to do more for our own people. In my state alone, in Florida, there's going to be 40,000 less openings next year for college students. They're making it difficult to transfer. The community colleges are being very selective, and they've raised the standards of the SAT and grade point averages. They're firing professors at our universities here, all because of the economy, because of oil. So there's a lot of, you know, when you talk about national security, it just isn't weapon systems that the Pentagon has. National security is also, and I teach a course on this, also protecting our own internal structure, our youth, education, whether it's teenage pregnancies or whether it's AIDS or whether it's rebuilding our bridges. And I think Obama appeals to those voters, and at the same time, he's very, very suspicious of these massive expenditures and new weapon systems. So I think everything's up for grabs. I think some people are hoping that we could live with a nuclear Iran. I don't think we can. I think that the Iranians would give a bomb, a nuclear weapon, to Hezbollah, and that's what the Israelis are afraid of. So nobody really knows what's going to happen. I think what you're going to see more and more of is accurate, actionable intelligence on the specific amount of weapons-grade uranium that the Iranians have. And I think you're going to get that from probably the Europeans, the IAEA, and so on. The Iranians today have about 3,000 centrifuges that could produce enough nuclear material within about 18 months. They've accelerated that, according to David Albright, who is probably the leading expert. You know, he's a former UN weapons inspector, worked at CIA, and he has a ton of analysts that just study what Iran is doing in terms of enriching uranium.
So we've
got only 18 months. We're running out of time starting about now.
Well, of course, the thing is that the thing that convinces me the Iranians are want to develop nuclear weapons is the fact that, of course, they're already getting their enriched uranium from the Russians for their power plant. If they can get the enriched uranium for the fuel rods for their power plant, then why do they want to develop it on their own? Unless, of course, they want to develop nuclear weapons. And there really are some people over there who would really want to precipitate a nuclear war. Now, that isn't logical, but we're not dealing with logical people. We're dealing with religious fanatics who really want to bring the Mahdi back. And until people understand that, so much of what's going on over there just doesn't make sense. Well, John, you go right ahead.
Well, I think following up on your point, you're absolutely right. And I think the Iranians, you know, they may also have a goal of having what's called almost a virtual nuclear status, which means that they don't have the bomb, but they could develop it pretty quickly. And Europe may be willing, and even the United States may be willing to accept that. I don't think the Israelis will accept it. The other thing is, the Iranians, when I was saying they've kind of outmaneuvered us, they have formed an alliance with Chavez that if there is trouble, they could, our oil would be interrupted. I mean, oil is a big problem in the United States now. I don't see the prices going down. So the Iranians are watching that. They have not given in to Europe or America on anything. They gave it their own. In mid-May, they gave their own package of proposals, which called for international talks, basically on the Arab-Israeli peace process, which is completely unacceptable at this stage to the Israelis. So the Iranians are playing hardball. They've given in on nothing. They haven't been forthcoming, and that's why there's been more sanctions, and they're getting squeezed more and more economically. So they're getting a little desperate, okay, and desperate people do desperate things. You know, what I'm disappointed at in our country is the quality of our intelligence is not good. We spend billions of dollars on technical means, overflights, drones, satellites, spying all in the Middle East, and we can't come up with a better estimate on when there is a possibility that the Iranians would have a bomb. The other thing about Iran's options, they could hurt us in a number of ways. They could accelerate their support for insurgents in Iraq, forcing us almost to attack them. They give lots of aid to Hezbollah and Hamas, as you know. They've also, we believe, given lots of aid to the Taliban. The resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan didn't come about by its own. Somebody's helping them. And they could even have a direct fight with the U.S. and Iraq or Afghanistan because they share borders with both those countries. So, and Iran is a large army. They have like half a million to 1 million men, and they have missiles capable of reaching the U.S., our ships there. And then, I don't know if you've noticed this, but 3 weeks ago, Chavez in Venezuela did 2 missile tests, and the Russians and Belarus have helped him build the missile defense program. He just came back from Moscow a few weeks ago. He bought 3 to 5 kilo-class diesel submarines, the same kind that the Russians are fitting the Iranians with to be able to sink our ships without too much difficulty. And then, of course, it could start this way. You know, Iran and Venezuela could do an embargo, a selective embargo against the United States. You know, and that would affect China, even though the embargo is against us, it would affect Japan. About 70 to 80% of its current oil exports go to Asia now, mostly to China.
Hold that thought, John. We'll be back here in just a moment when we bring our statements on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is John Quirk, who spent a lifetime in intelligence and still has a lot of fascinating contacts. John was just saying that if you look at Venezuela, Chavez is doing everything he can to prepare for a confrontation. He's actually buying missiles. He's done a couple of missile tests recently. And remember, these even intermediate-range missiles in Venezuela would hit the southern part of the United States readily. Not only that, but he's bought 4-kilo-class submarines from the Russians. Now, admittedly, they're diesel, but they're very hard to detect. And, of course, they're armed with state-of-the-art Russian torpedoes that could devastate, certainly, many of our ships and certainly our aircraft carriers, which is the very foundation of our naval facility. So, I mean, certainly the Iranians are buying these. Pardon me, I should say I think the Iranians have bought some of these submarines as well from the Russians, and now the Venezuelans have bought them. And the average American doesn't believe that these things could ever happen. They could never imagine another major war coming down the line. But as John was saying, if there was a real, confrontation with Iran, and believe me, we're talking about blockading Iran. That's an act of war. The American people don't seem to think so. But if somebody blockaded our country, it would be an act of war. And we blockade Iran, it's an act of war. We're talking about certainly blocking their bank deposits in Europe. That's an act of war, and that's actually going on. But what would happen if Iran and Venezuela decided to block oil exports to the United States? And, of course, insisted that they would cut off our oil supply. What would we do at that point? I mean, how would we survive with gas already, $5 a gallon? How'd you like to try $10 or $15 a gallon? What would this do to our economy? So you pick up the story there, John.
Yeah, well, it's a good point. I think when you're talking economics, you also have to talk politics. And there's an old tenet in foreign policy and diplomacy. Nothing unites a country like an outside aggressor. Nothing unites a country like a war. After 9/11, this country was completely united, and we blew it by going into Iraq when we should have gone into Iran. And I'm a guy that supported Bush, but I'm very disappointed in that whole scenario. So we were very united. We had the support of the world. Now Bush's popularity is down. American popularity is down. Nothing would unite us more like a war. So if Iran and Chavez try to do something to us, I think the American people would tighten their belts. They'd pay higher. Maybe we'd go back to gas rationing like World War II. But we would be enraged at anything they would do against us. I don't think Chavez understands that, and I think the fundamentalists in Iran don't get it. They don't really understand the power of the United States and how we would be united. The broker here to avoiding that is kind of China. China is Iran's biggest customer for oil. Iran also buys lots of weapons from China, and as you said, Russia. The trade between China and Iran last year was $20 billion when trade between Iran and Europe went down. China does not want us to attack the U.S. because they're afraid of a war and oil being interrupted. And they could squeeze us big time, as you know. We owe them so much money. And then, of course, people talk about the Islamic world. They would react very negatively against the United States. We have trouble in Pakistan, as you know. Turkey, which is an important ally, could be pushed more to the Islamic side. We could face our companies and diplomats and military bases overseas could face tremendous amounts of riots. So all of this stuff is very, very important, okay? And that's why I think we need a good decision and strong leadership. I think the problem I see is not on the United States side. It's on the Iranian side. Their fundamentalist Shia religion really controls that country. And they have a whole host of chips on their shoulder. They hate the Sunnis in Saudi Arabia. They hate the West. They hate the United States. They hate Israel. They're bringing up the Palestine-Israeli conflict constantly. They want to be the regional power in that part of the world. The United States does not want them to be. So there's, I don't see much of a breakthrough in diplomacy. I would say that the hope of many people is that the current government could be overthrown. But sometimes we delude ourselves. This is what we say. The young people in Iran want a change. The young people want freedom. They want better education, health care. They want more women's rights. They want to be able to travel. They want everything that the West has. But I don't think people really understand that Iran is a police state. It's really a police repressive state. Yes, you can go there and you can travel and you can see people happy. And
hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is John Quirk, and John was simply saying that the people in Iran, the younger people, and the vast majority of the population is younger because so many people got killed off in the war there, a foolish war back in 1980, where we were backing, of course, Saddam Hussein against the Iranians, but the younger people in Iran want freedom. They want to have the material things we have in this country, but they want the ability to be able to speak out. They want freedom of speech. They want freedom of the press. And none of these things exist in Iran under the mullahs, who, incidentally, everybody's forgotten, but who brought them to power? Why, we did back in 1979. And just as we overthrew the duly elected president of Iran back in 1953, Mossadegh, and we imposed the Shah upon the Iranian people, and then we overthrew the Shah, and we brought the mullahs to power. And it seems like everything we do gets us into more and more trouble. Doesn't make sense. You would think that once in a while the people in Washington, D.C. would do the right thing.
Well, you know, you make a good point, and I wrote about this when I wrote my book on the CIA, that Iran and the U.S. have a long history together. A lot of it's troubled and a lot of it's over oil. I mean, we went into Iran in 1953 and put the Shah in basically to protect Britain's Anglo-Iranian Petroleum Company. And then we got in and we took over and we helped the secret police, the SAVAK, and up until the 79 Islamic Revolution, and then later when they took over our diplomats for about 450 days. So these are very, very serious differences that we've had. The other thing is that the Iranians really have gone off the deep end about Israel. They never really focused on Israel before. I mean, from about the 1930s to about up until the 80s, they really they didn't care about Israel. It's only been the last few years that they've called for the destruction of Israel, and they feel a champion to the Palestinians, which I think is not real. It may be real among a few fundamentalists in the Iranian government, but it's not really real. And the Israelis last week, all the leadership in Israel, were most of them, about 80% of them, basically came out and said, attacking Iran in order to stop its nuclear plans is no big deal, and it'll be unavoidable, and there's nothing the Iranians can do about it. And I think for the first time, you've got France supporting Israel, the rest of most of Europe, especially the Eastern European countries, support Israel because of the United States.
Well, that thought we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. John, Dr. Stan, I guess, is John Quirk, and simply talking about what's happening. Everything seems to be pointing that we're heading into a crisis situation, but if you look at France, he points out that France is backing Israel, and many of the European countries, especially the Eastern European countries, are backing Israel today. Pick up the story there, John.
Well, Sarkozy, you know, I've spent a lot of time in France, and I was teaching there in May. I teach at the French Military and Diplomatic Academy, and he has really come out supporting the United States. And although he called for a halt to Jewish settlements, and the Israelis don't pay much attention to him or the United States on that, he did he did come along and say that he was strongly backing Israel's security. They won't accept the nuclear Iran. It's unacceptable for Iran to acquire nuclear weapons. And that France is going to do everything within the EU to make sure that Iran doesn't go forward. That's quite a change from when I was living in France and Chirac was there, pandering to the Iraqis, pandering to the Arab countries, and really doing everything possible to hurt the United States, including trying to sabotage us with NATO. So you've got France, and France is Sarkozy, the first president to visit Israel in 12 years, and he's very, very pro-Israel and pro-U.S. So but that doesn't seem to influence Iran. There's nothing that seems to influence Iran. We've offered them economic incentives. We've offered them diplomacy. We've offered them guarantees on not attacking them. We've offered them everything, and it's like the Iranians are playing a tough poker game, and they haven't batted an eye, and they haven't given in. And it's really, it's a culture clash, not a clash between Islam and the West, but it's a clash between the Shia interpretation of Islam and the West. It's a clash between Shia interpretation versus Sunni secularism. So, and I think, in a way, this is why Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, even Yemen, and other countries and other Islamic countries do not want to see a non-Arab Muslim country like Iran be the regional power. So it'll be interesting to see who makes the final decision on whether we go after Iran or not, whether the United States does it or whether Israel does it.
Well, of course, if we were to attack Iran, though, I would think that, Hezbollah, which apparently has, 30, 40,000 missiles, would launch them all at Israel and destroy Israel. Israel's a small country. You get a large number of these missiles, and some of them are pretty sophisticated that Hezbollah has today. And certainly, if either the United States or Israel were to attack Iran, I would think there'd be terrible consequences as far as Israel is concerned. I mean, it's almost as if we're in an impossible standoff.
Yes, just looking at the Iranian side for a minute, they believe that, not Israel, but they believe the West, in particular the United States, is out to destroy their fundamentalist government, their Shia government. And looking through Iranian eyes, this is what they see. They see that we support the Jewish state. They see we support a Sunni state like Saudi Arabia. And they also see that we've got 150,000 troops on their border in Iraq, and that we've the Iranians have said, we've bribed and paid off Turkey and Egypt. I mean, we've given them foreign aid. And that they see their fundamentalist government threatened. And then you mentioned the Maqti. They had this really almost bizarre cult fundamentalist belief that the end of the world for them, maybe the end of the world for them, is coming. The end of the world for everybody is coming. And you're right about Hezbollah. Hezbollah has not only been reinforced with new rockets since the Israeli incursion some time ago, but they have these new Shabbat missiles that can now hit any part of Israel. As you remember, in the last conflict between Israel when they went into Lebanon, I think the missiles could only hit parts of certain parts of Nablus and some of the border regions near the Lebanese border. Now they can hit Tel Aviv, certainly Jerusalem. They can hit the coast, all of Haifa. And this, you're right, it offers a tremendous threat to the Israelis.
So I think that we're living in very uncertain times. I don't think the average American realizes that. I think maybe he's obsessed with his own problems, the financial problems in this country, the moral problems in this country. But There certainly is a very real possibility that in the not-too-distant future there could be a major war in the Middle East. And if it starts, why, I'm really concerned that many of the Muslim countries, many of the moderate governments would be overthrown by the radicals, specifically in Egypt, specifically in Saudi Arabia, specifically, you know, in the countries down along the Persian Gulf there, even in Turkey. What are your thoughts on that, John?
Well, that's true. Egypt is very fragile because Mubarak is ill, and he's got, I think, 6,000 to 10,000 Islamic Brotherhood people in jail, and the cells for subversion that the Islamic Brotherhood have are actually strengthening. They're getting stronger. There's no real problem in Morocco or Algeria or Tunis or even Libya. They've become pretty good allies to the United States in the war against terrorism for the reason you talked about, the secular versus the religious aspects of Islam. But Turkey is also, people, you know, you have to underscore Turkey. Turkey could move more to a stricter Islamic view, even though going back to Ataturk and Mustafa Kemal, Turkey's been a secular country. They're getting fed up with the fact that they see racism in Europe against the Turks, and most of Europe does not want the Turks in the European Union. The European Union has a lot of problems now. The Irish just voted down another version of the Constitution, and it could be cracking a little bit. But the Turks don't care. They've been encouraged by the United States and promised that they'll get into the European Union, and if they don't, that fact alone could drive them more into the arms of the Islamic world, and that also means Iran. Iran, Iraq, and Turkey do have something in common. They don't want the Kurds to rise up. So I think the Saudis today are very solid, but they're losing confidence in the United States because we're not taking action against Iran. They want us to take action against Iran even more than the Israelis do. And then, of course, you've got Afghanistan, which hasn't been going well, and the Iranians are poised to help the Taliban. For some reason, we cannot wipe out the Taliban, and we've got lots of NATO troops there, American troops, French troops, but the poppy production is greater than it was before we invaded Afghanistan. I mean, there's more heroin coming into Europe, and as a result, Europe, Canada, and the United States than ever before. We just can't stop it, even with force of arms.
Well, we're not, like, you can't be trying very hard, though, John. I mean, you know, when you occupy a country, if you want to stop them from growing heroin, I would think you could really do it if you wanted to, but it seems like the people in Washington, D.C. aren't really that interested in stopping the world heroin trade.
They've tried, but their efforts are, you know, futile. They've tried. We've spent millions of dollars trying to get them into cash crops. We've got millions of dollars on military drug enforcement people there that we've trained in the Afghan army. And there's like a low-level conspiracy between even our allies, the Afghan allies down at the local level, the mayors and the farmers, with the poppy production people. And the poppy production people are all backed by the Taliban. So if you can't win, it's either you win a war there and stop poppy production, or the opposite, you destroy all the poppy production, and maybe that's the way to win a war. But as you've seen in all the reports, NATO is sending more troops, and we're not doing very well there. And even France is thinking of joining NATO in support of that, but we are not really destroying the Taliban. They're getting weapons and aid from a variety of places.
But don't you think part of that's coming from Pakistan? After all, that's where they're sick, where they're
coming
living.
Coming from Iran and Pakistan, there's no doubt about it. And then, you know, you've got these recent reports, very scary reports, that the Khan group, you know, the guy that developed, he's the father of the Pakistani nuclear bomb, has developed these small nuclear warheads, getting back to Chavez. Chavez is trying to obtain them. They're very small nuclear warheads. I mean, they can destroy more than a city. Khan has developed that, and the United States just found out about it. And Khan has supposedly been under house arrest for 4 years. So the world is really upside down. It's upside down in terms of global warming, in terms of immigration, in terms of finances and economy. And if you look at the history of the United States, when we were in a depression in World War II or various recessions before and after the U.S. Civil War, the only way a capitalist country gets out of that is by a major war, an international war, if you will. So, and the other thing is, our foreign policy people, you know, besides being diplomats and diplomacy is the art of negotiation, we're very aggressive people. We don't wait. We act. And this is a little different than the Iranian culture. The Iranian culture, like, it's almost like the Chinese. They think, hey, if it takes 10, 20, 30, 40 years, that's what it's going to take to win. We'll be patient and win. Where the United States is very aggressive, and we want a solution to the problems overnight. So you've got these two clashes of diplomacy and culture going on. And we do have other enemies. The Russians are not our friends. The Chinese are not our friends. And they're kind of on the sidelines benefiting from a lot of the problems that the United States has today.
Yes, and I think we live in a very, 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 very unsafe world, a very, very dangerous world. And the problem is the average American really has no grasp of what's going on, you know, and they're more concerned about, you know, the good life. But I think that we really have to look at things from the geopolitical point of view, which is certainly what our enemies are doing. And the Chinese realize that all they have to do is just sit back and do absolutely nothing, and we are going to go bankrupt as a nation. There's no better way to destroy a nation than, of course, to destroy its finances. And it would appear that the leaders of both the Republican and Democratic Party are intent upon spending and spending and electing and electing, but they're not interested in trying to protect the stability of the American financial system. I think that is one of the greatest threats to the United States today, is the corruption, the debauching of our currency. And yet there's not one in a million Americans that even looks at that aspect of it.
Well, I think you're right, and you're talking about money and currency. The Chinese have a huge checkbook, and they're both buying people, bribing people, weaning, and winning the hearts of minds in people in Africa and Latin America. They've got an open checkbook to exploit and buy resources. Also in the Caribbean, where we are, they've dominated the Caribbean. They control the Panama Canal next to Jimmy Carter. They are building ports all over the Caribbean and Latin America, and they are hungry for resources to keep their economy going. While their manufacturing base is actually expanding, ours is shrinking. And our car companies and other companies are in trouble. I mean, we're still a very, very rich nation. But I don't see, if we go into a war or we go into a deeper recession, I don't think we can pull out of it that quickly. In fact, Mr. Greenspan, who I respect tremendously, don't agree with him on everything. He said today, this is the kind of recession it will take many years for us to pull out. And as you mentioned, we kind of have a parallel economy. There's people with tremendous wealth in the country buying luxury goods and $20 million log cabins in Wyoming. And then there's the poor who benefit in many cases, not the working poor, but we have a welfare society where people benefit. And then the American middle class is getting squeezed on electric bills, on phone bills. I can just tell you, in Florida here, we have many houses under foreclosure, many houses abandoned. Many people cannot meet their electric bills, and the electric company is going for a big increase. The value of homes has gone down 25%, and yet the taxes are going up to offset that. And the average guy, the average American that makes somewhere between $50,000 and $80,000 just can't make it anymore in this type of economy.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that people really need to begin looking objectively at what's going on and what's really important. And certainly the Chinese are in the process of colonizing Africa. We've talked to missionaries from Africa. Chinese are going over there, going to all those countries. They're buying up their natural resources. They're using their military to back up many of the most ruthless dictators in Africa today, specifically men like Mugabe and Zimbabwe. And, of course, we're not doing anything other than, of course, we're continuing indirectly to finance Mugabe. is that the situation in Africa really is a dire one for the Africans. They've thrown off the colonization of the Europeans, and now they have the colonizations of the Chinese, and no way to fight it effectively because we're not standing in the breach. In fact, we're doing everything we can to build up the economy of communist China as they expand their influence throughout the world today, and none of this makes sense from a logical point of view. So maybe
About illogical. The United States gets about 15% of our oil from Venezuela, Chavez. Chavez is trying to replace that, and we pay on the barrel head. When we buy oil, we pay very, very quickly. Okay, he signed agreements with the Chinese to fix prices now, and they don't have to pay for a year, 18 months, which is just ludicrous. I mean, it's going to hurt the Venezuelan economy because if oil prices go up, the Chinese are benefiting. They just built a big pipeline and railway, the Chinese did in Venezuela. And Chavez hates the United States so much, he's like cutting off his nose to spite his face. He's giving the Chinese, who don't pay on time, big reductions in price, guarantees of pricing a year from now. They don't have to pay for something like 9 months to a year where the United States pays right away, which is going to affect the Venezuelan treasury. But the hatred against the United States is so much, he wants to do everything to damage the United States.
What do you think is going to happen as far as the economy in Venezuela? Are the people still behind him, the poor people, or do you think that they're getting to be some of the disillusioned with him?
No, there is no real opposition in Venezuela. I lived there a number of years. As you know, my wife's Venezuelan. I'm in touch with the Venezuelan opposition, which is completely penetrated by Cuban intelligence. Cuban intelligence runs the Venezuelan military, political campaigns. They run their intelligence service. They try to institute a few weeks ago a typical communist spy network. In other words, neighbors must spy on their neighbors, and if they don't, they can be prosecuted by the police. So there's going to be a referendum again in the fall, but he's probably going to ignore that.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest has been John Quirk. Fascinating, as always. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, John, you got 3 minutes to wrap up. You were just talking about becoming your friend.
I would stay on the same song I've been singing. I think that Venezuela is, in some ways, a greater national security threat than the United States. We look upon him as a clown and a buffoon. Our policymakers kind of look down on Latin America. They feel that we're disengaging from Latin America to move over to PACCOM and challenge the Chinese in the Pacific. But Venezuela has oil. They've been on a spending spree. They're funding a communist takeover in El Salvador. They funded left-wing drug dealers who are Morales, who's president in Bolivia. They've given lots of commitments to Ortega in Nicaragua and Ecuador. They've tried to influence. We had a number of agents and spies arrested in Miami some months ago. They were money laundering for Chavez to support left-wing candidates in Latin America. So he's not a buffoon. He spent $5 billion on Russian arms. They're building the missile defense program. The Chinese are there. Hezbollah, Hamas has an office. And nobody seems to be upset about it in our policymaking group. If it was in the days of Eisenhower or Kennedy or Johnson or Nixon, Chavez would be gone. But what we're doing is letting him get stronger and use his oil money that we pay. We pay him, we buy his oil, and he takes the money that we give him and uses it against us. And it's just incredulous. It's just unbelievable, some of the things that are going on. I just don't understand it. And we have no plans to overthrow him. We don't have big military in the area. The only hope is that some Venezuelans will overthrow him, or that the Colombians will put him in his place before he can wreak more havoc and buy more weapons that he could use against the United States.
Well, we live in dangerous times, and I think it's just important that we keep our eyes fixed on what's going on. And far as I'm concerned, I believe that behind so much of what's going on, there are powerful spiritual forces that are influencing things. And when we see something that doesn't make sense, we have to recognize the fact that there must be another explanation. Well, John, thank you so very much. I think you're going to be with us tomorrow evening for our late program, an entirely different audience, so you can say whatever you want to, and you can repeat yourself. I always enjoy hearing what you have to say.
I guess everyone has a good summer.
Good night, and we'll talk to you tomorrow evening. Bye-bye. Yes. Okay, fine. That was John Quirk. I hope you enjoyed his commentary. Always challenging, always very provocative. There's a great deal there. But, of course, as John says, it doesn't make sense, and we'll try to make sense of it when we get back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, off the air, John was just saying, so much of what's going on really doesn't make sense. Why are we doing something about Chavez? I mean, certainly if there was a right-wing dictator, we'd be down there trying to overthrow him, but we never really try to overthrow left-wing dictators unless, of course, they're going against our programs. To really understand the world revolution and why, for instance, we actually did everything we could surreptitiously to bring Chavez to power and Fidel Castro and the Maoists who just recently take over Nepal, you need to see our DVD, The World Revolution. And it's a talk we give. And, of course, there you'll actually hear my interview with Ambassador Earl T. Smith, the American ambassador to Cuba. And he will tell you that the United States knew Fidel Castro was a communist. The United States knew that they were bringing to power a communist dictator, and the CIA and the State Department worked together to bring Fidel Castro to power and keep him in power subsequently. Now, you have to understand that David Rockefeller's daughters are very good friends of Fidel Castro. If you doubt that, you need to get David Rockefeller's memoirs, which we carry. It's entitled Memoirs by David Rockefeller. You need to get the information. You need to understand that nothing is as it appears to be. The people who control America, our loyalty is not to this country. They're globalists, and they want to establish a one-world government and a new world religion and a one-world leader, or at least a ruling oligarchy. That is the plan. When you understand that, everything begins to make sense. That's why, of course, we brought Mugabe to power in Rhodesia back in 1980, and that's why we've kept Mugabe in power under one guise or another, even though he is a ruthless communist dictator. He's being kept in power by the Chinese communists who we are funding and financing today. And why would we be doing that? Well, let me suggest the pamphlet, The Communist Capitalist Alliance. It's a compilation of five of our newsletters, all very important. The term actually comes from Solzhenitsyn, from a talk he gave to the AFL-CIO, but totally suppressed by the controlled media. The Communist Capitalist Alliance, and pamphlet, you'll want to get the book, The Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. You'll want to get my interview with Professor Sutton, The Best Enemies, Money Goodbye. That's a DVD, The Best Enemies Money Buy. It's a classic because it explains to you how we financed the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War. Why would you do something that stupid? Why are we trying to build up communist China's military and economic potential today? Why are we shifting our factories over there where our people are going out of work? None of this makes sense unless you understand there is another agenda. And that's why my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or the CD, I should say the DVD story, is so important. That's the Brotherhood of Darkness. That's why you must see my talk on the forbidden secret. There really is a secret. It's been passed down for 5,000 years. People would never reveal it for fear of their life. And, of course, now Oprah Winfrey and Larry King are popularizing this secret. And, of course, Rhonda Burns and so many key people that she is in contact with popularizing it, and more Christians are turning away from traditional Christianity into mysticism and, of course, the other techniques that are already proposed by those people whose dedication is to the dark side. They're looking for reason for life, which they're not finding in traditional Christianity because we're not preaching the gospel in many of our churches. We're preaching a social gospel and how we're going to change the world. Well, we're going to change the world, but not for the better. So we hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to going to our website, getting our material. Of course, our website is radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there on the Internet 5 hours a day, or at least 4 hours a day live, 9 hours a day on our satellite feed. And, of course, you can get our afternoon programs. You can get our evening programs. They're archived there for many weeks, and you can get them in MP3 format. Our Saturday program is being put up on the Internet now as well. My son is posting a new section there, not only videos online, but other videos online. We recommend those to you. And, of course, we hope many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family and help us in this truly spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5.